Hello, Chitra. How are you today?
Hi, there. I'm fine. How are you?
Yes, I'm well. I'm well. I'm nice and warm in my room today. The light is on because it's dark and dingy outside.
Exactly.
Typical British weather, and I've got this temperament where the body kind of reacts to the weather. I don't know what you call that. But I actually do get a sort of a slight dull headache whenever it's raining and cold and windy. The three what is it? Weather horsemen of the apocalypse.
My remedy is hot tea.
Yep, yep. Yeah, I've got my third hot tea here now. And lots of paracetamol and so on. That tends to sort of get me going. So, what are you doing in this sort of dingy, place of the world where it's always raining and horrible weather here? Being from India, lovely weather in India.
Yes, that's the one thing I miss the most because even in winter, your temperature is around 21 to 25, and it's just so warm. When we go back now, I always try to go back there in December, January, February, because that's the winter months in India, but the temperature is still 25. We can walk with the t-shirts on. So, yeah, I miss the hot weather in India.
So what brought you here?
What brought me here? A good question. I guess I think I was in year 9, year 10, and I was in one of the English lessons, and I remember my English teacher talking about London, River Thames. It was just one of our lessons. It's what we call as a long lesson. So it's a very long, detailed about England, London, River Thames. So I guess at the time I fell in love with London. So as I grew up, I wanted to come and live in London. And obviously I became a medical doctor and then I trained in India and then I moved to London. That's how I ended up in London.
So what was it about London that you loved the most and you dreamed about when you were a young lady?
So I think when I was young, it's just that attraction, that River Thames, that London, Big Ben, wanting to live in London, wanting to make a change. And as you grow up, the challenges become bigger. So when I became a medical doctor, then I wanted to become MRCOG. So that was my dream in the medical school. So initially, when I started in the school days, it was just London was a big city and I wanted to live in London. And then when I went to the medical school, I wanted to have MRCOG. So I moved here and trained. And always the original plan was to get trained and go back to India. However, it didn't happen and I settled in London.
Why did you settle here? What happened?
I think I had my son and I started enjoying living in London. There are some parts which I love about India, and there are some cultural aspects and the knowledge and things which I love about being in UK and London. So, say for example, when I studied in India, it was mainly knowledge-based education. But when you come to the United Kingdom, and when I started working in the NHS, I realized how much of application of the knowledge I have to learn, how much of the communication skills I have to learn, because those are all not taught as a core curriculum when you studied in India. So the application of knowledge, the developmental opportunities. So if you're in India, as a doctor, I will end up just seeing patients after patient. But here, when I have become a medical doctor, I have got so many other growth opportunities. I can become a coach, I can become an educator, I can become an appraiser, I can become an examiner. So there are so many different roles you can hold in UK compared to India. I presume India has changed so much now and there are more opportunities there as well. But at that point in time when I studied, when I looked around, all my friends, they were running hospitals and seeing patients.
And what were the cultural shocks that you found when you came here to the UK, coming from India? I mean, whereabouts in India did you come from?
I've come from Chennai, South India. It's Tamil Nadu. I think it is now. We have gone back to Chennai. Yeah. I grew up in a coastal town, though, in Tuticorin. So, what are the cultural shocks? I think I passed my exam and started my work within a month's time. So, the main cultural shock was the communication skills. So, the completely the when you're consulting in India, it is more doctor-centered consultations. But when I came here, I had to completely change my consultation skills. And I really struggled in that initial stages to learn how to communicate with the patients, how to be able to articulate the diagnosis in a layperson knowledge. Because in India, we just say the consultation, the diagnosis, but here you have to explain. And it took a lot of time to understand how to change the communication style. And obviously, there are other aspects. Say, for example, the one of the things I always found is that we used to be so respectful of our teachers and colleagues. We always stand up when the consultant walks into the room. But here you call the consultant by the name. It took me such a long time to adjust to those sort of cultural changes as well. You can call a consultant by name, you can call a trainer by name. I just still find it's a little bit hesitant. It doesn't come that easily.
Did it upset you, or did you just sort of take it on as you know, something that you have to do?
It didn't upset me, but I just found it very hard. I just felt that if you don't call someone as doctor, somehow it's not being respectful. And it's just reframing your mind and saying that, okay, it's all right to call someone by name and being still respectful. And you don't have to have the Dr. Smith. You don't have to call someone as doctor, whatever is that. So it took bit of time to understand. So those are all the cultural changes I would suggest say that it affected me and it took time to grow.
Roughly, what kind of time period did it take you for you to kind of melt into the local culture?
Hot. I don't know. I guess that I'm probably still melting into the pot of the British culture. I will always be a mixed pot, being a British Indian rather than in one pot or the other. I still learn something. And there are so many simple words like interesting, means interesting in India, but interesting in British culture is completely different. When someone says that, oh, it is interesting. So, yeah, I think, yeah, I'm still learning.
Yeah, so of all these kind of gray areas what's the word? I mean, I can't remember the English word for it, where it has many meanings. You know, one word has many meanings. Idioms, I think, something like an idiom or something like that.
Yeah.
Were there any non-medical cultural shocks which you found a bit of a challenge at the time?
Non-medical cultural challenges. Yeah, one of the things I noticed is that because growing up in India, extended family is very, very important. I grew up with so many cousins, so many uncles and aunts, and that was a big cultural change or a big cultural shock. The families are very nuclear most of the time in Britain. And I think it is one of the things we are missing out, having the extended family, because you get a lot of support from having different perspectives, growing up in extended families. Everyone has a view. It can cause problems when you have so many extended families and so many views. But there is always someone you can use as a sounding board. Your age, your cousin, your aunt, not necessarily your mom and dad. Yes, of course, there is mom and dad, but there are things you might not be able to talk to your mom and dad, and there might be cousins similar to your age. And I think a lot of changes we are seeing in the Western world could be due to the lack of family support, extended family support. We had it very much in India, and I still miss it. Even though I say I miss it, I still have a lot of cousins. I can ring and speak to them today. And I still have my aunts and uncles. Whenever you have something, you just ring them and ask them, how do I do this? How do I do that? I still ring my aunt and ask for cooking recipes. So the extended families have a huge role, which I think is missing in Britain.
I mean, I love going back to Iraq because, it's just great fun. As you said, you learn different perspectives and ideas and ways of living, and you can always use the ones that you think would help you and, realize about your faults and follies, from your other extended family. I mean, the thing that I love the most is just sort of the general love that one feels.
Yes. Yeah.
Being around people that care for you.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of love and caring. And I think people are missing out. And that could be the, yeah.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, we have to extend that to our patients. May not
Yes.
sound, very GMC like and sort of professional like. But we have to extend whatever love and compassion that we've
Yeah.
received from other people
And
onto
that might be
our.
the reason why patients turn up to their GPs for all their trivial complaints, because there is no
Well,
one else.
I mean, a lot of people come to us as well, in our eye clinics, because they need, another human
Someone to talk
being.
to.
Whereas before, when I was a lot younger, I used to resent that. It's like, why are you here? There's nothing wrong with you, and don't waste my time. And so I spend quite a bit of time doing that. But I mean, having a culture where the extended family is sort of part of you, and you're part of the extended family, it just gives you that reassurance that there's always someone that you can turn to,
Yeah.
during a time of crisis.
Yeah. And you get a lot of role models as well, and you can model for different aspects of your life from those your extended family.
I mean, for me personally, there was a very big spiritual component in my life, which I found difficult to wrestle with coming here to the UK. So, my family's a well-known religious family. So that was a big part of my life. I mean, came here really young. So was that part of your sort of identity as well, or?
Yeah, I mean, religion is a very huge part of my life. It has helped me through. I mean, I don't leave house without wearing my vibhuti and things. I pray every single day because it helped. One, I have a very strong belief, and as you rightly said, it's almost part of my identity. And I was able to carry it over from India to UK, and I never gave up on that. And without religion, I don't think I would have survived my burnouts and all the difficult times, because religion is the one thing or the first thing I turn to whenever I hit a low point.
And I mean, how often does that happen, would you say? It's a regular basis or less often now?
The religion?
Sort of turning to it on, during the low points.
So, turning, I have made religion as part of my daily routine rituals. So, not necessarily, yes, of course, whenever you hit a low point, you turn to it. But I just get my strength from it these days. So it has become more of a positive aspect rather than to turn to only when you hit the low points.
Could you give us an example of that? I mean, how does it work on from a practical perspective?
So basically, from my perspective, I have got, first thing, I get up very early in the morning. I have a shower and have a 15, 20 minutes, certain verses and things which I recite from from my Bhagavad Gita and all the religious things. So which I, it just sort of frames my mind. It just ensures that I'm going to have a good day. It's almost like positive affirmation, if you want to call it. But I do it on a regular basis. And obviously, when you hit the low point, the way the Hindu religion works is that we always believe there is a reason for everything that happens to us. And at this point in time, what I'm going through is very, very difficult, and I don't understand. And I just feel that life is treating me unfairly. And I just feel that I'm not able to cope. I can't do it. And I just get angry at that. But when coming back to the religion and when realizing it just changes that perspective, I tell that it happens to me for some reason at this point in time. I don't understand it. I don't know how to deal with it. But I'm sure I have someone who is looking out for me and who is given me this difficult point, difficult time, low points, and I should be able to get around it. And I will get around it because I have been given it for a reason. And all I don't know is what is happening to me at this point in time. And I will be given the resources to come out of it as well. And that strong belief is the one which turns it around.
Have you always had?
Sorry if it sounds too woo-woo.
No. I mean, it doesn't sound woo-woo at all. Have you always had this strong belief in that there is meaning and reason behind every action that happens in the world?
I guess so.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, looking back, I think I had this strong belief and the passion and the purpose from a very young age.
And did you face any big obstacles coming here to the UK? Or did it happen plain sailing?
I wouldn't be here if the life has been a plain sailing, isn't it? No one will be here if the life is plain sailing. There were a lot of plain sailing points. I shouldn't forget the plain sailing points. I had a great family. I went through the medical school without any problem. I came to United Kingdom without any problem. I got through my exams. I got my MRCOG, MRC GP. I think I probably would say the first difficult change was shifting from the obstetrics because I was an obstetrician. In India, and I trained a lot in UK as well for in obstetrics and gynecology, and I loved it, and I absolutely loved it. But it was so difficult at that time to become a consultant. I'm not sure. Do you remember the Coleman training scheme? So as a visiting registrars, we can't get NTN numbers, and without NTN numbers, we couldn't become a consultant. So that was the first glitch or a low point in my life. So I did 2 years of fertility, and then I just realized that I can't get an NTN number at that point in time. So I decided, I was thinking about it, I decided that I like my autonomy so much and I wanted to run my own ship. So I decided that I'll give up obstetrics and change to general practice. Initially, I felt it was a sort of a failure when switching from one career which you love the most to another one. But then Once I entered general practice, I absolutely loved it because I would say that the maximum growth I had was in general practice. My clinical skills improved considerably. My personal skills improved. My professional skills improved. I developed so many leadership roles. I went on to do so many different things. So it was so great for the first 5 years of being a general practitioner. But then, of course, then the next glitch came. I think that's when, just before COVID, there were quite a lot of problems we started to encounter. The workload gradually crept up. There were some difficult times within the practice, HR issues, all those things. And that's when I started to go down without realizing, and I had my burnout.
What exactly happened at the time?
I think I still find it difficult to say that I had a burnout, because it is really difficult to accept that we go through burnout. And to me, the burnout is a huge range of symptoms. And most of us think that we are okay because we go to the work every day, we manage the work load every single day, we come home every single day. I didn't make any major mistakes. I didn't do misdiagnosis. So we are okay. And that's what I thought. But what has happened is that I stopped enjoying the work I did. It just became that I felt that I was dragging myself to the work. And there wasn't that enthusiasm. I just felt that I wasn't doing much. I wasn't making a difference. I was just there simply without enjoying it. And that was not me. I just felt I became really cynical, resentful, half cup empty person. My cup has always been half full. I never wanted a full cup, but I was happy with a half full cup. But a lot of times I realized that I'm saying it's half empty, it's half empty. And I just resented it. I didn't want to be that person who has a half cup, half empty cup. So, and that's when I realized, and it took me a really long time to accept that I need help and I need to do something. It's almost 2 years to realize that I haven't been enjoying what I was doing. Yeah, it was, yeah.
I mean, what changed inside of you for you to sort of change that way? What was it?
You mean what triggered?
Yeah, triggered, or what was there something that changed inside of you for you to sort of lose that positivity and half fullness within your being?
I think it is gradual. So many little things happened. The workload was increasing. There were issues within the practice. We were taking over another practice, and there were so many different little things happening. And looking back, I didn't have a good system or good resilience to identify and stop it at an earlier stage. You just went on a sort of a hamster wheel, wanting to do more and more without thinking what was happening inside me.
And you know, these days people don't like the resilience word. You know, whenever you mention the word resilience, they get very upset.
I
And I'd
know.
imagine, and I'd imagine you would have got upset then as well if people mentioned the R word to you. You need to be more resilient.
I don't know. I don't think that resilient word is a bad word. And I don't see, because the way I see it is that I lost control and I like to be in control. And being resilient means to me to be able to control what I do, how I do it. And yes, I can understand why people are upset. It's not that it's easier to change yourself. Right, yes, system is broken. I can sit here and say that I want my workload to go down. And that has to be done by so many different people. But if I make myself better in managing my workload, I don't know what would be the right word. I use the word emotional fitness with my clients because that goes down well rather than the resilience, as you say.
That's a good
But if
word,
I
yeah.
get myself better emotionally, it makes it a lot easier. Rather, I think we are all waiting for someone to come and change our world. I think we should change our world. There are things we can do to make our life better. And that could be different for different persons. And it's identifying what will work for you.
So
Thank you.
when did you realize that that something was going wrong, and you know what happened, and then what did you do afterwards?
So I just felt that I wasn't enjoying the work, but I know that I chose to become a doctor and I love my work. And I just did not want to do the work simply. I want to enjoy what I do. And to me, that is the most important thing. I don't think we should be simply doing the work because we can do the work. So what I did is I approached one of the coaches I came across in my scheme, and we had a very long chat, and that's when I realized that I'm just dragging myself and not enjoying the work, and that's why I'm being miserable.
Why did you choose a coach and not any other professional?
I guess that I had an insight to a certain extent that it's easier to change me and to find help within myself rather than waiting for someone else to change things for me. And I think one of the reasons people stay in a burnout or emotional unfit state is because we expect others to change things, or we blame others, we blame the system. They're all wrong. I'm not saying that the current system is wonderful or anything.
No, I mean, no system is wonderful. You know,
Yeah.
systems are by definition, you know, sort of a defunct system in order just to get results done. So, yeah, I
Yeah.
mean, systems are always broken.
Yeah. But my point is, we shouldn't be broken. We should never be broken.
I mean, you know, we're pretty, you know, we come back to the R word, but you know, I like your word of sort of emotional fitness. I think that's quite. You know,
Yeah.
that's a nice twist to things. So
Yeah.
a bit, but what gave you the insight to going into coaching? Because, you know, coaching, you know, particularly sort of a few years ago, or maybe a few decades ago, wasn't really accepted within the medical profession.
I attended one of our NLP sessions and I liked it. And the main concept is about how to communicate within yourself, have your languages or influencing your mind. And so I thought that NLP would be a good way. And reframing is very common in NLP, which is similar to the religion belief I had as well. So I went into NLP. And it got through me the difficult stages. I was able to reframe, see different things. And that's when I identified that I need to have that purpose and the passion to do my things. That's what makes me joyful and happy.
Yeah, I think NLP was very sexy about a decade ago. I think there was a bit of a wave of I went to Richard Bandler's seminars a few times, and really inspirational figure, and you know, very, very hypnotizing individual.
Okay, I have never had an opportunity. I should.
And what's his name? He came as well. Paul McKenna.
Okay.
So we actually treated Paul McKenna's sibling in the clinic. So I got to know him quite well. Really nice guy. And then he introduced me to hypnosis, and I did a few workshops and courses and diplomas in hypnosis, and then I found this really interesting American hypnotist, and he wrote the foreword to my book.
Oh, yeah.
So he was, I sort of I really enjoyed the, the mind games.
How do you think hypnotherapy fits in?
Well, I mean, it fits in, but I think, they kind of give it a sanitizing view of things just to make it sound more sterile and therapeutic. But yeah, I mean, everything in life is about suggestion, We're in a constant mode of suggestion and also negotiation and different levels of consciousness. So, in hypnosis, you're always trying to change the level of consciousness. Particularly from unconsciousness to consciousness. And then with hypnosis, you sort of put them back into the unconscious and try and bring out all of the unconscious things into the conscious world. So, to be honest with you, I don't know what happens, but it's sort of interesting, to change people's minds about certain things. Whether it's effective or not, that's a different discussion. And I think there's been a lot of research about, goes two ways, that it's very effective and that it's not effective. So, it depends on which school of thought you put your chips into.
I guess every program, every therapy works for certain people and not for everyone, isn't it? And it's finding the one which will work for you is the key thing.
I mean, I actually did like sort of a stage hypnosis session for a group of doctors. I did that in Basildon. It was great fun. I'd say 80% of it, 80% of the doctors found it absolutely hilarious and fun and enjoyable, and at 20% were just like, "No, this is blasphemy, and you should be burnt at the stake. You're a witch, and you should be burnt." So that was quite interesting. But yeah. I did
I'm
make
glad
room.
you found people to attend those kind of sessions. That's impressive.
Well, it was one of these sort of compulsory sessions, and before I went up, it was the GMC talking about whatever the GMC talk about, and then I come along and get them all hypnotized and rolling around on the floor doing silly things. And then the GMC woman came to me afterwards, and she wasn't happy at all. She said that.
You were in traffic then.
She said, "You're going to be in the papers soon, and not for the right reasons." And I said, "Well, that's life. What can I do?" So yeah, so you realize that there's other glasses to look at and other half full glasses to kind of sip in. What did you do next after that?
So I enjoyed the benefits I had, and then I trained to NLP master practitioner. And that's when I realized that I wasn't alone, that it was happening to most of the people. If you look at the GMC barometer survey, it just says 25% of people are at high risk of burnout, which is a significant number, which means it's one in four of us are at high risk of burnout. But I do think it is only a hidden part of an iceberg. There are a lot of people who are still going to work, managing to do the work, but not enjoying the work. And I think in 2022, there were a couple of suicides which really affected me. A general practitioner, a very young hospital doctor, consultant anesthetist. And it just made me really angry. I don't think not only that we are working without loving our job, but there are people who are willing to take their own lives because of the circumstances. And that's when I came up with my Lifeline Academy, and it was supposed to be supporting the healthcare professionals. It's a place where people can rest if they are finding it difficult, and whenever they are ready to move on, create where they want to go, there is a support available for them to do it.
Why did you pick those words, Lifeline Academy?
I think it was at that point when I was reading that suicide of the GP, it really, really affected me. And it was not a, I, she was a middle-aged woman with two teenage children who has held a very high-level post. And it's not that she wasn't struggling coping a newbie or anyone. And I think as doctors, we love metaphors. I love metaphors. And it just came to me, the word Lifeline Academy at that point in time.
So it was the fact that this person was in such pain and suffering and despair, and if they had a lifeline, maybe things would have been different.
It just feels so sad. It just takes 5 minutes if she has said, if any one of us, when we were desperate, we just need someone to talk to for 2 or 3 minutes, which will completely, we can reframe ourselves. Little movements, little physical movements, physical exercise. There are so many different things we can do to get back the control of life. We just don't have to keep doing what we are doing and just feeling the same thing over and over. It almost like the Groundhog Day. You just go and do the work without enjoying it, and it doesn't give any purpose. And that's why I just felt that I had to have a purpose and energy and the passion. And I started putting all my energy into supporting the people who couldn't get the support and reach out for help.
And how's the response been since you've started doing this?
I think it's very variable, and I still think people are finding it difficult to reach out, and still the burnout is a taboo. None of us want to accept that burnout is common, and none of us find. And as I said earlier on, that people think because we are doing our everyday work, we are okay. And we can be more than what we are at the moment. We've got so many potentials, so many things, each one of us. And I think, and that's a very good thing about the medical training, being a professional. There are so many opportunities out there for us to develop so many different skills. And enjoy the work and get the work-life balance. You can do this, you can do like what you're doing. You're being an ophthalmologist, hypnotist, coach, therapist, book writer. There are so many different things we can all do. And we are not recognizing the potential, and we are just limiting ourselves in certain ways.
Where would you like to see yourself in 10 years' time?
In 10 years' time. Where would I like to see myself? One of the things I feel strongly about is making a difference and helping people. So I would like to be in a position in 10 years' time where I'm doing still my general practice role, but at the same time, helping a lot of people and providing them the support they need.
How would that look like?
How will that look like? At the moment, I'm starting small. It is one army band. And obviously, depending on as I go along the journey, it will become a larger collaborative association.
Have you thought of doing sort of international work or sort of work back in India?
Yeah, definitely, because I do quite a lot of free coaching as well. People who can't afford to do through Coach Me free websites to various international people as well. So I do provide free seminars, webinars. Yeah.
And is it sort of has the burnout conversation reached back home in India, or is it still early days?
It's very early days. Because it is happening in India at the moment. I think the main burnt out is seeing in the postgraduate students in India at the moment. Because most of the time, when they qualify qualify after the postgraduation, they become independent or corporate doctors, which is equivalent to the NHS sort of thing. But during the post-graduation period, there were a lot of students who are still suffering.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to think about. I mean, I'm looking to do some work back home in Iraq, and there's burnout there. I guess they sort of call it something else. I haven't really worked out what exactly they call it.
And
But
yeah,
it's
I think that's the difficulty, isn't it? Burnout, resilience, they are not great words to be used. We just need to come up with different words.
I mean, back home, a doctor's considered a demigod, and these things are not synonymous with semi-deities and things like that. So it's a difficult discussion, but it's
It
something
is.
that has to be said, and has to be talked about. Otherwise, bad things will happen to them as well back home, and I'm sure they do. And but people don't talk about it because it's such a big taboo topic.
Exactly. And that's why I talk about it, because unless otherwise we say that it's not okay, yes, but I have gone through the burnout and I can come out of it. If I can come out of it, anyone can do it.
I mean, these discussions are not sort of fun, and it's not really great entertainment, but I mean, it can be sometimes. But generally speaking, they are difficult conversations, and not everyone likes to listen to these things. But we have to do them. And I mean, what's your sort of view on current, GP land here in the UK? I mean, we hear about a lot of bad things that happen in the press. What's it really like working in the sector?
I still love general practice,
Right.
and
You sound like the minority.
it is a mad world. I think if everyone thinks about it, really, we all love general practice. None of us will give it up, but we all complain about it as well. 10-minute appointments. The main problem is that unrealistic expectations. And obviously, the politicians will do nothing about it. NHS will always be something which they have to play the voting game, getting the votes gained on it. But patients are not being told the truth. What is it really possible and what can be done within the financial envelope, within the workforces, within the time restraints of any one individual, what is possible? We are trying to sell that anything is possible. Unfortunately, it is not. And it is a conversation. Again, it is a very difficult conversation to be had in public. And I think it is all the Royal Colleges, BMA, everyone has to come out and say what is going to be possible for all the patients in that. So in the general practice at the moment, we are drowning in the bureaucracy, trying to see the patients in 10 minutes, constantly increasing the workload.
And are would you say that the majority of patients are sort of more understanding once you have these difficult conversations? Or not really?
I mean, I would say that honestly, that 70% of the patients are really nice to treat and really it's a pleasure to work with them. And there are obviously 20 to 30% who doesn't understand what we are going through and they have expectations. And obviously, they have been told that the GPs are not doing anything and they should be seeing you at the drop of the hat. They believe in it and they can't be blamed for that.
If you were to change anything, I mean, I know that that's sort of outside your belief system, and but if we can just suspend that for this question, if you were to change anything, having come to London and seen the wonderful weather and the wonderful infrastructure of current London, which is absolutely wonderful. What would you have changed, as a a young girl dreaming about London, what have you changed?
What would I have changed? I mean, I guess I still love, or I would like to see my young 16-year-old, because she did not have a lot of knowledge. She doesn't have the experience what I have, but she was definitely headstrong. She was definitely determined. So I will definitely say a huge thank you to that young girl who was there. And if I ask her to change something, I probably would say, it's okay if you don't fit in. Don't be afraid that you're not able to fit in. To have the dreams, have your big dreams. It's okay to have your big dreams. The other thing I will definitely tell her is learn how to articulate and communicate your thoughts clearly. I really struggled to do that, and it took me a very long time, and it is still a learning, ongoing process for me. So I would tell that young girl, learn how to articulate and communicate your thoughts. What else I will tell? Probably learn how to express your emotions and feelings as well. I guess none of us are good at expressing how we feel, what we go through. Either we are afraid that we will get hurt or we will hurt someone else. And I think it is an important skill for everyone to have, how to express your emotions and feelings without hurting others and without getting hurt.
Yeah, that's a difficult one, you know, expressing fear and frustration and anger, you know, around other people. But one mu must do it in order to process it and learn from it and understand and you know, as you said, grow as a human being. Well, it's been absolutely great having you on the podcast and listening to you. How can people get hold of you? What's the best way?
They can reach me on my website, drchitrasankaran.com. I also have a brilliant quiz where you can assess how you're managing your work-life balance. And I always hang out on the LinkedIn.
Yeah, I mean, I must say you produce great LinkedIn posts, particularly on a Monday, which is very uplifting and thought-provoking, you know. Definitely vouch for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Haider. It has been a great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. Thank you for having you know, it's great having you on the show today, Chitra. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let me see. I can't see the stop button here. Recording. There we go.